Between the time when wargamers played with chainmail and the rise of the Wizards of the Coast, there was an age of gamers. And unto this, Gygax, destined to bear the crown jewel of TSR upon a troubled brow, to show you all how to roll for initiative.
Issue number 72 of the Roll for Initiative podcast. I am DM Vince, one of your hosts, along with DM Matt.
Hello, everyone.
DM Will.
Hey, what's up?
And DM Nick.
Howdy, everybody.
How's everybody doing this week? All at once.
Oh, good.
Doing good. Good, good.
Recovering from last night's game night.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute, so... Yep. So we're back in with another show and everything. Let's go around the table since Nick is. Let's talk about your game last night. You're recovering from, Nick.
Yeah, it was kind of, well. It was interesting, yeah. To say the least. We're doing that whole Castle of the Mad Archmage, and one of their encounters, they basically encountered Chucky.
Oh, jeez.
It was like the first combat out of the night, and I critted him. It was awesome. So, yeah, I use crits and fumbles in my game. One of those little house rule things. Like, no other DM has ever house ruled stuff, right? So,
what does this house you speak of?
They are mine, and they're in the house. Crits and fumbles. So, yeah, it wasn't much, though. But still, it was an interesting start to the evening. So, that was fun. And just kind of going through the day here, feeling a little tired, but...
Aww.
It was fun. It was fun, and hopefully next game night will be. Well, we usually only get together about once a month, but I got some news from my friend Jeff in Afghanistan. He called over Skype last night and said hi to him. So he's going to be back in April for his. He's going to have 2 weeks leave in April, and we're gonna have our game night while he's home on leave. He's really really itching to throw the dice down and. You know, kill monsters and take their stuff.
Yeah.
It'll be a good time.
Cool. What about you, Matt? What have you been up to?
Well, I thought I had my gaming group starting up last week, and as I was walking to my car, I realized, wait a minute, we canceled this session, and our first session's tonight.
No.
So, yeah, at least I didn't actually drive to the guy's house and be like, and have him not be there because he was out of town. So, and then I had something happen during the week that was rather exciting gaming that I can't go into. Maybe at the end of 2013 I can talk about it, but it was rather rather exciting when it happened, so that's all I can say about that.
So, Will, we're going to get outside Matt's house, we're going to beat him up until he tells us what it is.
I have his address.
He can't even tell us what it is. I mean, you can't. I thought, or you just can't say specifics.
He can't say anything at all.
Yeah. Really? I mean,
he's under NDA.
Yeah. I've signed legal documents.
That's a strict NDA. I've done an NDA saying, I'm doing this, this, and this.
Well, it's one of those things I would just rather not have people know that I know that the stuff that the, about the thing.
And they'd be hounding you, too.
Exactly. Then it'd be like, oh, well, he said this, and they start reading into it way more than,
right.
So, yeah.
Okay, we'll tell everybody. It's about a new game about puppies.
Yes. Let's see here as I read it over.
Oh, P&K, Puppies and Kennels.
Yes.
I thought it was going to be Bella Sarah or something.
Bella Sarah.
No. I'll tell. It's the new Pound Puppies RPG.
Oh, dude,
That's close to Belisar.
Is that like Dog the RPG by Kenzerko?
Possibly.
Like out of the Knights at the Dinner Table comic?
Yes.
Dog the RPG?
Yeah.
I'm so in for Pound Puppies. They're awesome.
Yes. And then the crossover with My Little Pony.
And everything all links to Pokemon somehow.
Yep.
Pokemon. Anyway, Will, what are you up to?
Oh, not much. I think the most exciting thing was that my One Pathfinder group, we completed our campaign. So they finished at around 15th level. Someone finished at 12th because he died too many times. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Next weekend, we're going to roll the first level characters, and then we're going to start off playing B1. And from there on, do that until the next Pathfinder Adventure series comes out.
Oh, so you're going back to playing AD&D again?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They take breaks from time to time. My second group will be finished next week, and we're going to do just board games for about 3 months straight until the next Pathfinder Adventure series comes out. And that's pretty much all that's going on. I'm gearing up right now for all the conventions that's going to happen in this area. There's two more that I've been asked to go to, so I got to do that as well. So this is a ton of things going on right now.
B1, that's the In Search of the Unknown. That's right. Isn't that right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And that's the one that I always run first when I play first edition D&D with people that have never played first edition at all.
Good start, yeah.
You could find a full review of that module by Will at our RFI.com, RFIpodcast.com, I should say. Started putting up the reviews that Will was posting on the forums on our website for people to find.
Cool.
So I have B1, B2, B3, and B4 up there. So check them out. No, it's my turn.
Yes. Yep. What have you been up to?
I almost started my first edition game here in Texas, but a couple people bailed out, and another person couldn't make it, and then I wound up falling and hurting myself down the steps. So,
How much damage? D6? D4?
Probably a D4 damage to my knee.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah, it was enough that it irritated me enough that I didn't feel like walking.
Oh, you're high enough level. You can handle it.
Yeah.
I guess you found out that your infravision doesn't work too well, huh?
No, my infravision through boxes carrying upstairs doesn't work too well.
That's a low dexterity check or something.
Yeah. Anyway, so I actually did spend time playing in the RFI community game on Saturday nights with Leaf and Drama Man. I was DMing that game last night. I was DMing an RPGA module from the early 80s. So anyone could join that game, by the way. All you have to do is have a microphone and Skype and time to play on Saturday nights.
Oh, sounds cool.
Yeah, we had about 4 or 5 players. A lot of fun. Yeah, Nick, you were on Skype last night and I was pinging you. You weren't answering.
Well, yeah, that's because my friend Jeff called in around 8 o'clock from Afghanistan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so yeah, I was...
How dare you ignore me? No, I'm kidding.
I'm sorry. It was kind of an important call. Sorry.
Yeah, so that's that. Probably we continue the 1E game eventually, so who knows. I started blogging again, so I started putting some monsters up on my blog for Mazes and Perils, if anybody's interested in that. And that's about it. Nick.
Yes, sir.
Stars.
Stars, yes, this week. On our iTunes Stars review for Roll for Initiative podcast, we have one new review from J.M. Lyle. It's a 5-star review.
Woo.
And he says, or she, I don't know, just J.M. So it's great show. It says, really professionally run show with quality content, starting with the very first episode. So we're professionally run?
Well, we are, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay, then.
We can't get like sound effect in the background, Matt, of the Resident Evil guy, Nemesis from Stars. I'm going, Stars, Stars,
Stars.
So that's, that was our one review. And still, everybody out there, if you'd like to give a review to our podcast, you can go onto iTunes, type in Roll for Initiative on search at the iTunes store, and just go ahead and click on the links there, and you'll be able to give us a review. We read them all, and we really appreciate the feedback. Or you can contact us at rfistaff@gmail.com.
Wow, Nick is on the ball. The email.
Yeah, because I'm reading it right off my computer here. I cheated a little.
All right, so on a serious note, Aaron, since the last show, we've had two huge announcements.
Yes, we have.
Yep.
The WotC Wizards of the Coast boards, the announcement of a 5th edition, or as people were calling it, D&D Next, yeah. And the announcement of the reprint of the core 3 books from 1st edition with the money going to the Gygax fund.
Yep, portion goes to the Gygax, Gygax Memorial Fund. Excuse me.
So let's start off with going around the table, what everybody expects or what they think maybe about 5th edition or D&D next. Nick, what are you going to start with?
Well, when I saw the news, I was like, well, interesting. I have my own opinions on why that happened. So, you know, I didn't want to, you know, get too much into, like, personal explanations, but I thought, you know, this is a good move. It sounds like they're reaching out to everybody. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, I signed up for the playtest. You know, if they're really making an effort to reach out to everybody who from all different editions and try to get everybody's feedback, then, you know, I'm all for it. You know, I know we've all been burned in the past by these people, but hey, you know, let bygones be bygones. That's how I kind of look at it.
So, yeah.
That's me.
Matt, your thoughts about 5th edition?
I really think I'm willing to give it a chance. They really seem like they've been trying to bring back in the older gamers, those that are actually heavily invested in the legend and the lore of D&D. You start finding references to Greyhawk and just even some of their 4th edition books, like when they brought out Mordenkainen's Magic Emporium. Most newer players have no idea who he is. Us longtime players, no. So yeah. They've been doing a lot of things like that. Even in their Conquest and Wrath board game, you start finding references to the Tomb of Horrors and various other first edition adventures or basic adventures. So I think with this new edition, they're going to start trying to tap into those people that they may have lost over the years and bring them back at the same time, not causing the same split that, say, 4th edition did, or even going from 2nd to 3rd or 1st to 2nd. Instead, they want to see if they want to try to hit that happy medium where we all edition players can get along and role play together and sing Kumbaya. So whether or not they achieve it, that's another story, but I'm willing to give them a chance.
Yeah, okay. And Will?
Well, let me say from this perspective, March of this year, that will be my anniversary, and that'll be 37 years of gaming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that time period, you know, I cut my teeth on chainmail, mm-hmm. and I barely remember playing war games back, you know, back even before then, but I mean, it is what it is. It's going to evolve. I mean, that's just the nature of the gaming world. I mean, I know some of y'all played Axis and Allies. I mean, mm-hmm. look where it's at right now. It evolved into, you know, different games.
Yeah.
D&D is just going through that same phase. You know, it's going to continue to evolve. And that's the same. I apply this analogy to technology. Okay, I mean, I didn't have cell phones and beepers back then when I was young. I didn't have that stuff, or Kindles and Nooks and all that mess. So people are evolving it with technology. It's only logical that games as alone are going to evolve with the passage of time. Mm-hmm. And that includes, I don't know if y'all play an Atari 2600.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Did you have the Texas Instruments computer?
Yeah.
No.
You see what I'm saying? I mean, it's just going to happen. That's just the way it is. So it's like this. I have an open mind. I'll give it a shot. I gave 4th edition a shot. I gave 3.5 a shot. Gave Pathfinder a shot. I give a lot of games a shot to impress me and say, hey, what will this do for me and my friends? If they're having fun, the game is good to go.
Right.
So we'll just deal with it as it comes.
Yeah. I agree with you there. I'll give them a shot as far as looking at it and trying it, much like I did 4th edition. But I hate to say it. I don't know how they're going to impress the grogs. It's just
I agree.
Well, there's some of them they'll never be able to impress because their first edition was the pinnacle of gaming, and they will not accept anything else.
I wish they wouldn't lie as far as saying we're going to include rules to make it like 0 edition and 1st edition. You can't. It's just going to be a slimmed down version of D20 rules.
I mean, if you wanted to take a system and steal, say, different aspects from the various games, because there's a certain way for handling proficiencies that is very 2nd edition and that's very 3rd edition. And so you could pick one of those and maybe you handle your attributes more in a fashion of 1st edition. But you're at the same time, you're stealing maybe some of the other character creation or rules from the different editions. So you could actually kind of hodgepodge them together. But in doing so, you could create something really clunky. So I think that in lies the key, because every edition has their strengths and weaknesses. And if you were to take the strengths of all the editions, I guess the question is, would they make a good game?
For them,
would they work together, though? That's another thing. You got to look at also another issue, at least that I had when 3E was released, was backward compatibility. I do remember, and I was involved with that whole first to second edition AD&D deal, and I remember the thing in Dragon Magazine, their questionnaire. In fact, I think I still have
a
questionnaire for that.
Yeah, I do too. See,
when second edition AD&D came out, there was really not much of a backward compatibility issue. Your old modules, your old adventures worked just as well in second edition. Yeah, there was a few other minor changes, but all in all, it was the same game mechanic.
Yeah.
When it came from like second to third, I thought it was tremendously different when it came to a backward compatibility issue. My argument to give an example of this was the conversion book. I remember the little conversion book. I still have it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have that too.
From second to third, from like up to for third edition, it's a 20-page book.
Right.
Well, it's a 20-page pamphlet.
It's a guide pamphlet, yeah.
I'm like, really? 20 pages?
Yeah, but my thing is
backward compatibility.
Well, this is what the issue is, though. But see, this is what the deal is with conversion. You make conversion as easy as you want or as difficult as you want. I did not need a conversion book from 2nd to 3.0. There was no need to use it. A goblin in 3.0 is the same as a goblin in 3.0. You just change the stats. I mean, it's not that hard with copying down things. I mean, that pamphlet was for people that say, I want to convert my second edition character to a character in 3.0. Oh, man, give me a break. Just start
at
first level
and
start
all
over.
The majority of it was trying to convert your character. Good luck. Really good luck.
Yeah.
I mean, there's virtually no way of doing it.
Yeah.
Now, as far as, like you said, like monster stats, for the most part, it wasn't too bad. But then again, you still have a whole different game mechanic. You have a whole different setting up for saving throws. The whole D20 system is different. There's no combat matrices to follow. It was a different thing to follow. And I just, you know, it wasn't, it's like, do I really want to relearn all this? Do I really learn a game like this?
That is so funny because I remember the learning curve between first and second just with Thaco. Good Lord.
I don't understand why there was such a huge learning curve for that. In fact, Thaco is not something new. We talked about that. That goes actually, it's hidden in first edition.
Yeah,
you got to look for it, but it's there.
Thaco is not first edition. I stand by that.
In first edition, it was based off of a chart that had somewhat a linear number system. In second edition, it was entirely linear.
Yes.
Well, here's another question that kind of leaps to mind on this since we're talking about this new edition that might be coming out. What would you like to see in the new edition of D&D? Like, free events, what would you like to see in there? Maybe one or two things. What would you like?
I'd like to see them go back to the system with descending armor class.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm with you on that. Absolutely.
Nothing. I don't want everything based on just a D20 roll, so everybody can figure out what they have to roll and what they have to roll to hit.
Yeah, I agree.
I hated that about third edition. It's like, all I need is a 17 to hit everything in the world.
Right. Now, I'd like to see the descending armor class too.
Yeah.
I would also like to see separate class for class level XP. You know.
Yes, I like that too.
And maybe just me, I like to also see the level names back. I think it's just a cool little added little flavor thing. But I'd like to me, it makes sense to have separate like experience charts for each different class.
No skills. We don't need skills.
Right.
Yeah, for me, I just want to see the return of the Vancian magic. I really dislike how magic's handled in 4th. Because really, who does a ritual in 4th? Does anyone? you basically took away all the magic that wasn't combat oriented and just said, "Eh, it's not that important." With
isn't
the way-
it in fourth edition, can't you like get like automatically healed? You can actually automatically heal yourself somehow.
Through the use of second winds and various
there's surges.
Healing surges.
Yeah, those healing surges I heard about. So, you gotta remember, I know virtually nothing about 4th edition. I paged through the books, and in like 5 minutes, I just had to put them down.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways in combat to heal, and that was one of the problems that made 4th edition combat so long, because you were constantly healing. And those healing surges replenished themselves in each encounter.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you could just keep going and going and going, because they were trying to do away with, well, we fought the first group of monsters in this dungeon, but now we're all banged up, so we're just going to head back to the town, rest a day, then continue on to the next room, go back to town, rest, and repeat.
They didn't want that anymore.
They wanted a video game it.
Right. They wanted to they went from more that simulation style to the more arcade.
Yeah.
Where you get more action and things that just, if this were to be a real universe with dragons and fairies, you're seeing way more action even than the average adventurer would in that universe.
So would it be fair to say that maybe, I know this is a game about fairies and dragons and elves, but bring some sense of, I guess, realism?
Yeah, well, I would say more lethality. Because if everything...
There you go. Now, that's a better... Yeah, you're right. There's a better explanation.
Right, so that way, yes, we're fighting just five goblins, but one of us could die.
Right. Right. You know what? Good example of that. Last night, they were fighting... what the heck were they fighting? Troglodytes.
Mm-hmm.
Within the first round of combat, I had two deaths of player characters.
Right.
I mean... There you go. I mean, that was it.
Right. And yeah, it just that just makes each encounter mean something when, you know, we could die, whereas, oh, it's a group of kobolds. We'll just mow through them and go on to the next.
Right.
They're not as threatening.
Big meat grinder, yeah.
Yeah.
You could sit in an RPGA game now and listen to it for about 3 hours and not hear one death.
Wow. Really?
Death in an RPGA game? That's just crazy talk at this point.
Yeah. Unless someone does something stupid like running off a cliff or running into a dragon by himself. But playing OD&D or AD&D, when they had their tournament modules, they were deaths all the time.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that I think that's a good point, is brings a sense of lethality to it.
Yeah.
And it's going to make you more cautious.
Right.
And and also make you think more.
Right. I mean, there's...
Bring it at first.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some. I think there's a balance to be achieved. You don't necessarily have to have like the one hit kill that would befall a lot of first edition characters when they have like 6 hit points or 4 hit points. We don't necessarily have to go back to that. Whereas if you get poked with a dagger, you're now dead.
Right.
But we don't have to go, well, I've been stabbed 20 times and I'm still going. Not everyone is Rasputin.
It's just a flesh wound.
Yeah.
I kind of like the big giant spider in basic edition, the poison or die.
Yeah, save or die. Yeah.
Save or die. One big shot, boom, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah, bring a sense of lethality, fear is a great motivator. I've always said that.
Right.
It's a good way to motivate your players that, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit of fear, a little bit of trepidation, right. if I'm using the turn right, you know, you're going to think about things more. You're going to think before you leap out into the fray.
Right. And that's what also would make them heroes. They know this is dangerous. They have that fear, but I'm going to do it anyway for the greater good.
Exactly.
It makes for a better game. If you're going to sit there and just be like, all right, we run inside, we kill the dragon, as opposed to, oh, that dragon could probably kill us in one shot. What should we do? How do we get around
that? It's like, you need this spell. Okay, well, I got to somehow research that. Okay, we're going to need this here and this here. Okay, you're going to back up the fighter here if he gets hurt. You know, a little bit more urgency. So, what about you, Will? What would you like to see in the new edition?
I agree with some of y'all comments, but I also disagree with a couple. Let me tell you what I do agree with. Vancian magic is the staple of Dungeons & Dragons, and it should always be a staple of Dungeons & Dragons, regardless.
Yep.
Yeah.
removing it from Dungeons & Dragons, it is not Dungeons & Dragons anymore without Vancey and Magic. I think that is the biggest mistake of 4th edition. Right. So I agree with that portion. Now, an armor class, if you want to bring a sense of reality or lethality to the game, I don't know if you're familiar with role-playing systems like Harnmaster or Chivalry and Sorcery.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you put on layers of armor. So underneath a suit of full plate, you have another layer of armor that gives you added protection to various, you know, parts of your body. Mm-hmm. Now, in those systems, weapons do a set amount of damage. A two-handed sword does 10. Well, if that 10 does not get through that armor, depending on where it hits them, you know, the armor will take damage, and, right. you know, so
I'm
think
familiar
that
with the Hackmaster had the same thing.
Right.
Yes.
The Palladium
does like
what?
That. Yes, and I like that system, and you might want to think about fatigue when it comes to combat.
Yep.
If you go through Hackmaster 10 rounds of combat,
too.
Exactly. Right. Those are things I think, I think they should look into these kind of things when they make this new D&D next, what have you. Like I said, their intent is to make it a modular system that's going to appeal to everyone. Well, and I do agree with the one statement that the older gamers, I don't consider myself a grognard. I don't care for that term. I'm just an old experienced guy. I prefer experienced. Some of them said they will never go back unless the art is from that era. Well, I guess y'all are out of the picture then, guys.
Yeah.
Go away, go play tic-tac-toe or shoots and ladder or something, because they're not going to that.
I've read that too. It doesn't make any sense to me either.
No.
What if Errol Otis and all those guys were dead? What are you going to do now?
Those guys too. I mean, who amongst us isn't? Who doesn't love Errol Otis's stuff or Dave Trompier's stuff or Sutherland's work? I mean, come on. Those guys that did fantastic work, but you know what?
It's 2011.
Only one is still doing artwork for them, and
not everything has to be anime style. I mean, I like anime, I love watching anime, but not everything has to be anime style now.
Right.
I have to look at that from a Star Trek point of view, and you know, I say like, what is the graffiti in a Star Trek universe? It definitely ain't going to be Errol Otis or Trampier. It's going to be Romulan art, or you know, something crazy, Ferengi art. You know, they're not going to.
Chad reading a donut. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hey, you know, it's going to come out when it does. Hopefully they will listen to the input of the people that signed up for it. And hopefully Wizards of the Coast will take that input and use it wisely in their next incarnation. We all have our points. And now, lethality, that's one thing they need to bring back is characters got to die.
Yeah.
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 Every player needs to have that first level character they created die in the first session once. They need to learn an important life lesson. Yet, don't get too attached or be very careful if you want this character to live.
It should be mandatory. You make a character up and rip it up right after you're done.
Right. Well,
and surprisingly, I saw one of those grognard sites, and they was complaining. They didn't like the instant death. And I'm listening to this, and I said, you guys confuse me. Because I saw how they made a description of the Bodak. If you look at a Bodak, if you fell the saving throw versus death, because they have... Yeah, you're dead. They said, I don't like that. I don't think they should die. I think they should change it to something else. And I'm thinking like, you confuse me. First, you want old school art, but you don't like the old school saving throws. Choose and pick. You know, you're not going to agree. This next edition is not going to agree with everyone. You know what? All I can say is go get that Monopoly game and get ready to play.
Right. Yeah.
And there's different versions of that game, too.
Right.
Yeah.
At least we're not killing characters during the character creation process. We haven't
like Traveler.
Yes.
Oh, man. I can't stand Traveler because of that. Roll 2d6. I rolled a 3. You're dead. Start over. What?
Great. Wonderful game. Thanks.
Yeah. Boy, Rolls do not like you. That's the third character that died during creation.
Oh, man. I hate a Traveler.
Yeah, living in the Imperium's a meat grinder.
let's leave it as is. You can join the forums, osrgaming.org/forums. There is various topics on D&D Next that you can join in and argue with us about how it's going to suck or not suck. So let's just hope Wizards of the Coast takes the Paizo route and listens to their fans.
Yes.
Okay, so the other announcement was the reprint of the core books. Now, some people were excited. Some people were pissed. I'm going to have to say I'm more on the excited side just to see the books reprinted, something to have on my shelf, collector's edition, especially if it's going to be a Gary Gygax like type monster on the front. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will buy them even though it's going to be $35, $40 per book. I will buy them just to support the fund, but how much is really going to the fund? They haven't said.
You know what? Doesn't matter. I think it's a bold move that they're doing, that they're giving a portion of the profits to the Gygax Memorial Fund. And if people aren't aware of it out there, the Gygax Memorial Fund was set up by Gail Gygax and I think a few others in the family and some on the outside. I think Frank Metzer's involved with that too, if I recall.
Yeah, Tavis Allison and a whole bunch of the gangs invited. But also what a lot of people don't know, that there's a feud right now in the Gygax family. Are you all familiar with that?
Oh, geez. Now what?
Oh, yeah. There is a schism between Gail Gygax and the immediate family of Gary Gygax. Remember now, Gary Gygax got divorced and remarried.
Right, yeah.
And both of them had different views and everything. And what I'll do is it's stated on the Escapist magazine site, the Escapist site.
Yeah.
Which explains the whole detail of the schism. And so, and like y'all, I'm excited for the books to come out. I ain't care less about the Memorial Fund, really. I mean, he's been gone now, what, almost 4 years, mm-hmm. unfortunately. Mm-hmm. How can they be missing money? I don't see how not enough money has been generated within 4 years. That's a long time.
So what's the split over exactly the exact split?
It has to do about where the site was going to be. It had to deal with money and a couple other issues. I really don't like get into the drama of all that mess. I really care less about
it. Well, also, the Memorial Fund's only been out for – it's only been around for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
But like I said, though, you can't tell me that they couldn't get enough money yet. I'm just having a hard time. How much is this memorial going to be? Is it $1 million? Is it $10 million? It's not a huge memorial.
From what I understand, they want to have a statue within Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, in one of the parks of Gary. And I don't know how much it's going to be. I don't even know how much they've raised. But I know that the Memorial Fund has only been up for like a couple of years now.
And all that should be public knowledge.
They had to have raised a lot because, well, Gen Con 2010, they saw a lot of rare stuff from Gary's.
Right. So I'm not sure.
It just goes on and goes on and everything, but the Escapist covers that.
Besides that, beyond the Memorial Fund, about the books, when I read that news, I was happy as could be. I thought, wow, this is really like out of nowhere. And I'm telling you, those of you out there who posted like, well, you know, if Wizards of the Coast ever reprinted the core rule books, you know, then maybe they'll get my business. Well, guess what? They called bluff. So the three core rule books are going to be back out there with new art, new cover art, but all the interior is going to be the same.
Well, I hope the cover art is going to stay similar to what it was originally.
I hope so, too. I hope it's tasteful. You know, I know beauty and art is in the eye of the beholder, but, you know.
And I also hope that it's going to have a TSR logo on it, not the Wizards of the Coast logo.
Well, we'll see about
that. Yeah.
I'm getting it for the collector's version point of it. I mean, it's limited.
I am going to order my set. It is a limited to a North American release, but, you know, we'll see how that goes. We've all heard in the past about where things have been, quote unquote, limited release. And if there's enough people wanting it, you know, they might broaden it out. Who knows?
Wizards directly or your local gaming shop. You can't go on Amazon.
Yeah, you gotta go to your local gaming shop. And, you know, kind of an upside to that was looking it up on Wizards website, and they have a store locator. I am so like, there's a new store that just opened up. I think last year or a couple years ago, nearby. I didn't even know that they existed, and I'm going to go down there. I'm going to pre-order my copies.
That's the way to do it, pre-order them. I'm going to pre-order three sets, and if anyone out there listens to this, and if they're outside the continental United States, send me an email. You send me the cash via PayPal. I'll get you them. I'll order them for you. Just pay for shipping and the insurance, and I'll gladly get them for y'all.
Wow. Yeah. Be sure that they pay for the shipping because it's a lot to ship overseas. So
the shipping and insurance is insanity. That's why they're paying for it PayPal.
Yeah. Well, that's very nice of you. There you have it there, folks. RFIstaff@gmail.com. Just address it books pre-order to Will, and we'll get the email over to Will, and he'll contact you privately. So, okay, with that, we'll just leave it at that. And whatever you guys think is great. I know I'm getting some books. Matt, you didn't really say if you were getting any at all.
Yeah, but I was actually just trying to, since the Gygax Memorial Fund is a nonprofit where you can actually tax deduct your donations, I was just trying to see if I could dig up their, because I know 503Cs actually have to file like annual reports.
Yes.
And I was just trying to see if I could find that, and I was having problems locating it just to see where the money was going and all that. But as for the books, though, I'm definitely getting a set. And if this does well,
maybe they'll reprint other ones.
Yeah, then maybe they'll reprint other ones. Or maybe it'll just cause some newer players, hey, maybe let's try out first edition.
They might reprint Unearthed Arcana and it won't fall apart in like a few years?
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
Right.
Why isn't that only one book?
Right.
I hear it from everybody.
Yeah.
Of all the other books, Unearthed Arcana, it's like you look at it and it like crumbles to pieces. I don't get it.
Did they say if it was being printed with the errata in it or not?
They haven't said if it was going to have errata or what is going to be in it, other than it's a reprint of the books.
Okay.
So we'll find out. I can only hope it has the same typos, the errors.
Well, I understand it's $45 for the DMG, mm-hmm. and I think $35 each for the Monster Manual and Player's Handbook.
Right.
If I remember correctly.
Wow. A lot more than it was back then.
But I've already seen the discussions on it, and people have said, you know what? Taking in inflation into consideration, it's almost like the same. So,
I don't think so. No. Anyway, let's leave it at that. Let's head over to stage four.
Master, they're at the gates again. Master, it looks like another band of adventurers!
Adventurers? Again? Always the same. Coming to me for sage advice.
Sage advice this week?
Sage advice.
Me and Nick are going to sing a duet. Oh, sorry. Sage advice for rfystaff@gmail.com. We have a couple emails this week. The first one is from Tim. And he says...
He's an enchanter.
Yes, he is. He's talking about, does AD&D 1E have rules on exorcisms? And if so, would a cleric be able to use it versus a demon or a devil?
Well,
Nick, you said you had to answer this one.
Yes, I am. Okay. And there is, I guess you could call it a rule, there's a spell. It's a fourth level cleric spell in the first edition player's handbook, and it's exorcise. And I don't think I've ever used this spell. I had to read through it again, and quite interesting is it's range is one, duration permanent. It's either a creature or object, has verbal, somatic, and material components. Now here's what threw me on this one: the casting time. 1 to 100 plus turns. That has to be either potentially the longest casting time for any spell I've seen in the game ever. And there's a reason behind that. Basically, the description is the exorcism will negate possession of a creature or object by outside supernatural force. You know, things that may be possession by magic jar spell, demonic possession, curse, or even a charm. For the exorcise spell is similar to a dispel magic spell. So if someone has been like a charmed person on them, you could use exorcise on them. And thus a soul object of any sort, blah, 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 you know, the successful exorcism. Well, here's where it comes to the 1 to 100 plus turns. Basically, each turn that the cleric performs the exorcism ritual with the exorcise spell is a 1% chance per turn cumulative that he can successfully perform the exorcism. So, and there are some other modifiers involved with that that could be plus or minus 1%. So, yeah, it could take a long time to perform the spell if you're going by the book here. So, yeah, there is a, I guess you could call it a rule, there is a spell involved with it. as far as like any other rules that might be in first edition AD&D, I'm not well aware of it, but I find it interesting that, you know, it is a spell in itself and it's not a actual part of the cleric's repertoire, like, you know, turning undead, because the ritual of exorcism historically is like knowing from a Judeo-Christian sense was, you know, or really any religion, the ritual of exorcism really in any religion is one of the pinnacle moments of proving your faith, of how powerful your religion is by expelling what are demons or devils.
Exorcism is only limited to Catholic religion, actually.
Negative. That's not true. In Judaism, the Kabbalists, those that do Kabbalism, there is an exorcism spell, a ritual, actually, not a spell, but a ritual, which is done as well, too, in Kabbalism, which is in the Judaic tradition.
Also in the Muslim faith, I even believe in some Eastern religions.
Yeah. Hinduism has a version. Yes. Yeah.
There is some ritual to expel evil spirits, demons, whatever you want to call them, from a person or a place or an object.
Yeah. It's just that most people, when they think of exorcisms, they think of either the book or the movie, so they take a Catholic view on it.
Judeo-Christian view of it. In a real-world sense, most of your religions, either Eastern or Western faiths, do have some sort of a ritual that allows you to expel, cast out the demons from your spirit, you know, things like that. So exorcise the demons from your soul, you know, things like that. But yeah, it's not uncommon. And I remember writing a paper about this not too long ago about Saint Caesarius when he in the early beginnings of the church, while it seemed like in the church that to supplement the older gods from like the Romans and some of the older Greek gods when Christianity was coming in, some of those gods were actually shown as being demons. They were put in the same realm as like other demons involved. So that's how a lot of Christianity became more influenced within the area. So yeah, it's there's like, as far as like a game mechanic thing, you got the fourth level spell, but there's like no other like rules per se that I know of.
Well, Will, you were saying something beforehand about not agreeing with that.
Oh, well, actually, like I said, this is a spell. I think this is the only mention of anything concerning exorcism. And as I read the question, I was thinking he was looking for a specific ritual. The only thing I can tell you is to Wikipedia exorcism.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And use that right there, those guidelines on that.
Yeah, if you want to expound on it, get an actual idea of what a ritual would be. Yeah,
right.
It's a good reference to it.
Now, the best source, if you really want to, you know, I know this is a first edition podcast and everything. There's a phenomenal second edition supplement called Bastion of Faith, which covers exorcisms and the new exorcism spell. And since it's all brought up, I'll probably just go ahead and post that on the review once this podcast is done today.
Cool.
Okay.
But I really don't know. I don't know why people want to get involved in that exorcism stuff. That stuff's scary.
Yeah.
I think this is what Gary Gygax was having his issues back in the early days with all the, the South and everything, demons and devils.
True. Okay. Second one comes from John. He said, is there a necromancer class for 1E? Or do players just have to deal with the whole evil cleric control undead and pretend to be his playing one? It was dope. As far as I know, there was never an official necromancer class. I believe there was a couple. There was one in White Dwarf, right? A while in number 26, was it?
You're talking about the necromancer that was in White Dwarf magazine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one was, I thought, an earlier edition. But as a matter of fact, let me see here. White Dwarf 35 and 36.
Okay.
Okay. And I do. The only thing other I can think of was when there was the Death Master
in Dragon Magazine,
and he was, and that was an NPC class too.
There was a blog that I found before the show called Dangerous Brian, or Gamer's Blog, and he has a necromantic class in the works for first edition / Osric, and you can find that at dangerousbrian.blogspot.com.
Okay.
But one thing I'd like to add there on as far as that person asked that question about the necromancer class, and he brought up the thing on the whole evil cleric control undead. Basically, the necromancer in White Dwarf magazine is a magic user.
Yeah,
it's not a cleric.
Well, I always thought of a necromancer being a magic user based class anyway.
Me too.
Yeah, same here.
Yes, and if you find out that you know, like lawful good clerics cannot cast the opposite of their heal spells, like cause serious wounds. Later on, you'll find out that that's actually necromantic related spells where you cause damage with those spells instead of healing people with them.
Is it? And you know what? Necromancer is actually a level name. It's 10th level magic user. You're called a necromancer. So there you go. Right before you become name level in wizard, as wizard.
Sounds good to me. Yeah. Okay, so our last email comes from Mega Powers Dude. I like that guy. I like the name. Can you tell me about snow elves? I remember reading an article about that in Dragon a long time ago, and I was wondering what the difference between that and a normal elf was. I did find an article actually in Dragon 155.
Page 26.
Yes, regarding snow elves. Yep.
Do they live in the far north and they build toys for this big fat man?
Those are gnomes.
Yeah.
Okay. Just checking.
Anyway, you can look that up. There's some. They have some good. I just lost the friggin' PDF. Darn it!
I just threw them off. Yay! I win.
No, it actually. I opened the PDF and it went boop. It disappeared. So. They get a lot of good bonuses on throwing things and being, they can, you know, whatever. I don't know. Just look it up.
Well, I can tell you this, though. When I saw this question, I went online to the site today, and I posted a really nice article on elves, on all the known campaign systems and fantasy is concerned. And I believe that snow elves are only found in Greyhawk, the world of Greyhawk.
Really?
Yes, they are not in the Forgotten Realms. I didn't see them in Dark Sun. I mean, like, duh. They didn't mention them in Ravenloft or any of the other settings, Birthright or what have you. Yep.
I'd like to look up more about that stuff about the Snow Elves, if you can
Send
more on that information on them. They sound pretty cool.
Yeah, the Snow Elves, they get +1 on their saving throws against any form of cold attack or condition. They get +1 to hit with any spear or javelin, but no bonuses to hit with a sword or bow. Snow Elves also have a chance, have the ability to set traps with a 90% chance of success, provided they're in snowy regions.
Wow.
And each trap does a maximum of 2d6 hit points per level of the elf who sets it.
Whoa.
Yeah. I can just imagine trying to sneak up on a village of snow elves and all the traps they would have set.
Yeah,
that's insanity.
Yeah.
Are those NPCs? Or is that like a non-playing race? Or is this like a...
It doesn't really say as far as...
No, this is actually a playable class because it says... Snow Elves class limitations, so they can be unlimited in Druid, depending upon their ability. They can be up to a 13th level fighter, up to an 18th level wizard, unlimited in Thief, or a 14th level ranger.
Oh, wow.
Ice campaigns are cool campaigns to play.
Yeah, they are. Ice snow campaigns are the funnest.
Anyway, do they take extra damage from fire attacks?
From what I'm seeing, they don't actually have any specific vulnerability to fire. So it's more like the cold just made them hardy, not extra vulnerable. So, let's see. And then, there's actually quite a bit to their villages, and they actually align themselves in different clans of like 3 to 30 members, and they have like small villages with like dome-shaped huts of woven tree. So yeah, it's definitely worth looking at if you have any interest in running like a Arctic or snow campaign. It's Dragon Magazine issue 155, page 26.
155. So. I might have that one. I'm not sure.
All right, cool. So rfistaff@gmail.com for sage advice or phone in 570-865-4210, the hotline.
That line.
Where things are standing by.
Yes.
We don't know what.
Not yet.
Maybe a crypt thing.
Ooh.
So then it just ports you back before you called the hotline, then you call again only to be ported back to before you called the hotline?
Yes, until you finally get a dragon.
Yeah.
And we'll head into Table Manners.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, a fella knew how to judge a fireball on the fly and how far the cleric could push the undead he turned. I tell ya, with all these min-maxers and munchkins, metagame and power game, there's something missing that I'm here to learn ya. Now sit down and crack your book while I commence to teach ya some.
Table Manners.
Okay. Today, on Table Manners, we're going to cover playing a Kensai, which is in the Oriental Adventures Campaign book on page 16. The Kensai basically is a fighter. I suspect it's a fighter. Y'all tune in on me if you think I say something otherwise, but it actually is an ultimate master, a one melee weapon or martial arts weapon style.
Mm.
That's what I'm looking at, what the Kensai is and everything. Now, I did not play too much into Oriental Adventures back in the day, but I do know a couple things about them. Mm-hmm. So basically, he must master his weapon and himself. Now, I think they were real Kensais, according to what they say here. They were real Kensais back in the day. And they applied their training to simply a sword. But in first edition D&D, they kind of broadened the horizon on weapons. So they can use different types of weapons except a sword, such as halberds. And, there's some other weapons they can use.
Yeah. You come on with your weapon, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But they also, it's considered dishonorable, however, to use weapons of the ninja.
Exactly. Mm. And that's one thing that if inexperienced players do not know anything about Oriental Adventures, this system, this rule set uses honor, and honor is a really big deal, and the Kensai is affected by that honor system. So, but one thing that I did notice about Kensai, every day he must train and practice at least a minimum of 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has to.
Right.
If they don't, they do not get to advance as fast in level, if I'm correct.
Right.
So the 2 hours of training is like the montage training shot.
Right. Except they have it every day. And for every day, 2 hours they are short in training, before they can advance in a level, they have to make that up.
Do they make the really cool 80s sound montage music soundtrack too?
Of course. You're the
it's
best.
It's a montage.
Around. No one's ever going to keep me down.
But see, if he doesn't do any training, if he has enough level to experience points to level, he has to do that training first before he can advance to the next level.
Mm.
So that's one of the highlights of the Kensai. A couple other things. They have a natural armor class, almost similar to a monk.
Wow.
Yes, and so that was really interesting. How do you figure that out? He begins his natural armor class between 9 and 5, and how to find that is you have to subtract the character's dexterity score from 23, and that will be his natural armor class.
Oh, okay.
That's a kind of unusual. I've never seen that, you know, that used before, so...
It's one of those optional things that I guess they made up when designing this. So.
Right.
And what's funny is that as players and as DMs, as you look at the Kensai bonuses with their experience levels, I think you can see where where feats start coming in, because this is what I look at as feats.
For example,
you see when I come on their special abilities, they only get them at certain levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
you know, for example, experience level 1, already they have an initiative bonus. And that's one thing I like about the Kensai, is because this is a character that moves very quickly. So he gets, you know, added bonuses. The higher level he goes, the faster he will be on the initiative track. And that's one of the best things about the Kensai.
Right.
But special abilities that I'm referring to is, like, at 4th level, he gets meditation. At 6th level, he only surprised on a 1 and 6, which I believe, who was surprised? Isn't that the old elves or rangers?
Yeah, an elf was on a 1 and 6 in the basic. Yeah. Remember that?
There you go, see? Yep. And then at 7th level, which is funny because at 6th level, he gets the 1 and 6 surprise. At 7th level, he gets 2 weapons and fear, which means he gets to use 2 weapons simultaneously with no penalty whatsoever. And he causes fear.
Like a samurai, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. At 9th level, he gets 1d6 pupils. I guess he becomes a teacher of some sort. So here he goes. Here comes out, you know, our non-party fighters for us.
Foul. Yeah.
And at 11th level, there's a whirlwind attack. And if you all don't mind, there's a fire engine or a fire truck soon to pass by here, and you hear the alarm. It's a fire truck full of Kensai coming to the attack. So, I mean, it's a very interesting character. He also has that ki power, which allows... Is that how you pronounce it? Ki or kai?
I always pronounce it ki.
Ki?
I always went ki.
Okay, I'm just making sure I don't, you know, mispronounce it, offend
anyone. I pronounced it rutabaga, but go ahead.
Rutabaga. Okay.
What this ki power allows the Kensai to do, it lets him cause maximum damage with a single attack when using his specialized weapon. So he has to declare this before he makes his attack, if he's attacking a ghost. I'm going to channel my ki energy for this one attack on the ghost. And the ghost immaterializes and nothing happens anyway, so he wasted it for the day. No, it just, you know, he can use that ki power once per day.
Okay. So is it like he becomes like a whirling dervish or something like that?
Now, that's at 11th level.
Oh, okay, at 11th.
He makes that whirlwind attack. The ki power, he just focuses energy into his weapon, and for that one attack, he does maximum damage.
Whoa. Oh.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yep. I really found interesting in this class is when you level, there's that 10% chance times your level that you'll be challenged to a duel by another Kensai of your same level.
Exactly, yep.
And you have to take that, and it's not right when you level. It could be like right when you level, or it could be somewhere down the road, which gives you a good storyline for a DM. Mm-hmm. But if you fail that duel, you lose your level and honor.
That is the same thing, almost analogous to how the druid needs to level up high level, because he has
or
to
a
fight
monk,
that.
I think, too, right?
Yeah, I believe so. They have to fight that because there are only so many characters of that class could be at that level. You have to fight them and knock them down a level so you can continue on. Yes, yes, exactly. I think that's awesome.
It's not a duel to the death. It could be a duel to hell where they greet you, like first blood, you know, first person to, you know, fall to the ground unconscious.
First one who cries like a little girl.
Yeah, so that brings in some interesting role-playing, you know, scenarios when the Kensai, you know, gets up to that level. But as you were mentioning about the whirlwind attack, this is an additional key power.
Yeah.
And this is where he concentrates his bodily energy and bursts into a blurring whirlwind of motion. Something similar to that that Tasmanian devil guy that goes around the whirlwind of Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Yeah, there you go.
He's probably not going that fast.
Yeah.
He can only do this with his specialty weapon, and he attacks all opponents within 10 feet of him once in the same round.
Wow.
Yeah. And so all other the hidden damage bonuses apply, and he cannot use his key power to guarantee maximum damage, so he can't use this in conjunction with the key focus power, where he does that maximum damage. It's only one or the other. So he can attack every opponent within range at the end of the attack, regardless of the number of attacks he normally is allowed.
So this would be a good thing to use if you were surrounded.
Yeah. Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
And I can see this was definitely influenced in second edition with the Swordmaster and things like that, this whole entire class. So,
of course. And, you know, they have to be lawful alignment. It can be evil, good, or neutral. They have to be lawful alignment. And I believe they can only be human and that other weird one. Oh, the spirit folk characters. And what is that one called? The Henge Yoke? How do you say that?
I'm not up on my Japanese, so yeah.
Oh, I have no idea how to say some of these words. That's probably one of the reasons why I didn't really get into Oriental Adventures, because I hate mispronouncing words and offending anyone. But whatever, I think those are the shapeshifters, if I'm correct. The Hengoyoke?
Right, okay.
Yeah, I believe those are the shapeshifters. So those are the ones that can be these Kensai characters. Very interesting class. It is, I guess, a warrior, a 10-sided hit die. So they use 10-siders for hit points. And I'm trying to see what else. You know, I mean, great character to play. I think they're pretty cool. They're immune to fear.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's funny, because not only are they immune to fear, but they cause fear when they get to level 7.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, the Kensai, as reading, it's almost like a weird fusion with Monk and the Cavalier class, in a way,
and
you
a
know?
Paladin. Yeah, and a
and
Paladin.
A Paladin. Yeah. Yeah. It's like you took little bits of the Paladin class, little bits of the Cavalier, and threw in some of the Monk class, you have the Kensai.
Yeah, interesting. I like the Kensai. It's a very interesting character. You know, I really like it. My only recommendation to those people out there that are really into the Oriental Adventure side of the house, and I mean, don't get me wrong, great source book. I think it's incomplete in a lot of ways. If you want to supplement Oriental Adventures, get the Legend of the Five Rings.
Oh, yeah.
RPG.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, you cannot go wrong. And you know what? To even supplement that, get the Oriental Adventures from, I believe it was 3.5 that had the Oriental Adventures, that real big book.
Yeah. Yeah, it was 3.5.
You can supplement your first edition game with all those resources and come out with a very awesome game.
Yeah, the Five Rings definitely with that rich background that they have.
Believe me, yes, you are so correct, Vince. I mean, I'm telling you, I have no problems with this system. I think it's a great setting. It just needs to be compiled in a Legends of the Five Rings format, which is great.
Yeah. Now, I do remember when I first got the book here, and like as far as like a background using it, you know, in a game world, it left a lot to be desired.
Yes. But I will tell you, even though that it left some, the Dragon Magazine did cover a couple articles, and not specifically on the Kensai. I'm just going to say the issue numbers, and I'll say them slowly so people can write them down. Issue number 32. Issue number 40, issue number 31, issue number 26, and issue number 104. And that covers Oriental weapons, Oriental undead, Oriental armor, and some of them actually cover more on the world of Oriental Adventures. And I cannot forget number 189, which covers kits for the second edition. All these things can supplement a first edition Oriental Adventures campaign with no problems, really.
Wow. Oh, yeah, I wrote down a list of them, too. There was 31, Armor of the Far East.
Yeah.
Arrows of the East, number 146. Orient Adventures Class Combinations from 289. That's more a third edition type.
Right.
There was number 318, Update Orient Adventures Eastern Flavor. An earlier edition one, 151, Earn Those Heirlooms. 198, Soul Swords and Spirit Slayers, and there's Lords and Legends in 123, and it goes, I have a whole list here, on and on it goes.
It's awesome. I mean, there's lots of information out there. If you want more information, please ask us, and we will direct you on the right path.
Perfect. Okay, so let's head into our next segment of Game Mechanics.
Oh, man, what the heck is that?
Stand aside, you fool. I have a spell that will work here.
What do you mean I can't hit with that? All right, fine. Show it to me in the book.
Welcome. Game Mechanics.
Okay, folks, in Game Mechanics here, this is DM Nick, and kind of going with our Oriental Adventures theme, sort of, to this week, is a spell out of the Oriental Adventures book, and this is, again, boy, this is one of those spells where you go, wow, what were we thinking? It's the Fate spell, and it's a It's a fourth level spell for, let me see which class it's for. The Sukunja class, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And basically, the fate spell is kind of, it's a, obviously a divination spell, and it's a very long fortune-telling spell. It takes six turns to cast. Need all three components, verbal, somatic, and material. And the area effect is one creature. Basically, the person you're casting it upon who wants, you want to know their fate. And it's almost like predicting the future of a character. And just a little bit on specifics of the spell, the specific questions cannot be asked or answered, nor are the exact circumstances of the events known, like the location or the date. So it's at least it's a little vague.
Yeah.
And one of the things I is interesting about this, there are two ways that the DM, you can decide the answer. Either the DM knows the event that's going to happen in the future for that particular character and kind of pattern an adventure around that. That's kind of like railroading in a way, but you know, that's one way you can go. Or they do provide a quick and easy D20 chart that you can roll off of, and it's as open as you can want it. Say, for example, a character will overcome some great opponent in a valiant struggle. It's one of the rules. Or the character will come into a great fortune that will bring ruin and hardship to his house. Or powerful beings will show compassion upon the character, sparing his life in an unexpected moment. So there's stuff like that. And all the statements are very general, and they provide basis for further adventures. Now, something that's a little bit difficult that you're going to have to work out here is it does state that the fate is not an absolute event and unyielding. Rather, it is the potential for what may occur. So the actions of the character are the player's choice, and his actions may change the final outcome. So still, it's a really hard spell because there's all these kind of things that you have to take into consideration. And also it says determining a fate does not make the character immune to death. Well, obviously. There's also the idea of this fate spell is like, yes, this fate's going to happen, but you don't know when or by whom or where, but it's going to happen to you. But it's up to the DM that you got to kind of plan this thing out, and you might not be able to escape this fate. But then again, maybe you can. So it's kind of vague on that. It's almost, if you read the description, I had to read through it and think, boy, it almost contradicts itself in the area. But this spell is really, really, really weird. I don't know if I would use it. It just seems like something very difficult to play out for me as a DM when a player character is going to use this spell on some other player character in a campaign. I just think it's going to be really hard to do as far as, you know if they play this out, I got to roll it up. And I got to think of how I'm going to work this into the campaign. It might be easy, might not. Maybe the best way is just play it as loose as possible, I guess, would be the best way to do it. So it could be something that you might not even want to play out at all in the future. And it might be a fate that's far, far in the future for that character, maybe on his deathbed and it happens. Who knows? So you might not even have to worry about it as a DM. So, I don't know. I read through it. It's like one of those spells that if you introduce it into a campaign, I think could really, it could really muck things up, like a limited wish or a wish, I put it like right on that level with a wish or a limited wish or alter reality spell. Mm-hmm. It's pretty close to that, but it's only a fourth level, so go figure.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it that strong just because it does have that caveat of anything the player does may change this fate. So therefore, yeah. You always have plausible deniability when they say, well, my fate said this would happen, but it also says your actions could affect it, so you mucked it up.
Right, right. So, yeah, it can be that. It's just you just don't know. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. It's one of those weird spells.
Right. I don't know. When I read this, I just actually started having visions of the Smurf movie when Papa Smurf was cast doing some divination of the future of the Smurfs for whatever festival it was. And then they saw Gargamel having the Smurfs in the cages. And then they clumsy Smurf reaching for the wand, and it cut off.
You actually saw that movie?
Yes, my roommate drugged me to the Smurfs movie.
Hey. NPH is in that.
Yes, he is. And it was actually very cute and amusing. I enjoyed it.
Be dissing NPH. Neil Patrick Harris, baby. I
don't know. Okay, then. Moving along with this spell.
Never mind.
I had to think about that. Who? NPH? Oh, Neil Patrick Harris.
That's right, baby.
Wait, Jonathan Winters did the voice of Papa Smurf, so that, okay. That's too.
Yeah, this is an interesting spell. It's an interesting spell. This is almost real similar, you know, when I do Ravenloft stuff with the tarot cards.
It's like a foretelling thing. Yeah. That's
what I look at it as. And like I said, you can play this within the adventure somehow, role-playing-wise, and make some interesting things. And it also gives the player some time to think, whoa, I just got my fortune. This might happen. You know, whatever the case may be. It's an interesting spell. A good DM has to know what he's doing and how to immerse it into the campaign itself.
Yeah. Like I said, I think if I had this spell, if the characters would use it, I would probably play it as loose and as open as possible to give myself a little bit of breathing room, a little bit of leeway where that fate might be.
Oh, who's allowed to cast the spell again?
It's a fourth level Sukunja spell.
I just love the way you pronounce it.
Sukunja, wherever it's
Shikinja. I say Shikinja.
Shikinja, yeah.
Shikinja. Whatever, tomato, tomato. But, it's a fortune-telling spell. I almost picture it like, yeah, having the fortune teller. They go to a fortune teller and they do this fate spell. It's a long casting time, 6 turns, holy moly.
Yeah, 6 turns, what, an hour?
That's 1 hour, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
What about you, Vince?
What?
About the spell.
It's not something I really toy with because I don't really do the future fates thing because I'm a very on the fly DM, so
yeah,
too much planning for me. I would be like, no, your fate is you're dying, that's it.
It's everybody's fate.
But I will have to let you all know, if you take a look there at the bottom of page 65, look at the last spell in the first column.
Exercise.
Yeah. Yep. I told you it was in their Oriental Adventures as well.
Yeah, yeah, it did.
Yeah.
And that's not to, you know, pump up your guns and everything and get out there and sweat it out. That's the exorcism stuff. Okay, with that, we'll head into the Creature Feature Theater.
That is not it. It's not getting eternal life. And with strange ears, even death may die.
I welcome the unwary to the Creature Feature Theater.
The Creature Feature Theater this week. We have an interesting little monster pronounced the Shan Sao, which I don't know what Shan means, but Sao means pole, up something. So, but basically, these are the Smurfs of the Oriental Adventure race. They are 1 foot tall humanoids who live in the woodland hills. They are extremely fearless and private race. They have little communication with the outside world, and they are quick to take offense and equally to return it. And they are quite adept at defending themselves. They can polymorph themselves 3 times a day to the shape of a bird. It's one of them, usually flying away. In combat, they fight with short swords, which probably would be 2-handed swords to them at that point. Darts and the Unichine. Did I pronounce that right? Unichine. Uchini.
Hey, don't ask me. I'm the one who pronounced Sukinja wrong.
Yeah. Once bit, it caused disease.
It's a Sukini Jinja, whatever that is.
Uchine.
They can summon 1 to 3 tigers within a half a mile radius. Wow, that's pretty dangerous.
You're kitty, kitty, kitty. Oh.
Those tigers reserve a reserve. Yeah, they reserve their flights and they come in 1 to 6 turns. They got to declare security.
How else are they going to fight off Gargamel? I mean, really?
They fight for the Sun Chao and are able to understand his desires and needs. There's a 5% chance that they can encounter blah, 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 the Wenju. Hmm. Basically, here are your little annoying creatures in the forest, like the Smurfs, just not as friendly. These are like the evil Smurfs.
Yeah, they're chaotic neutral, so they are insane.
Yeah.
And the females have 1 hit dice, while the regular have 2 to 4 hit dice, and they defend their home to the death. There is a 10% chance if you stumble upon a village that 1 or 2 tigers will also be guarding there. And the Sun Chao are like grumpy old people. They don't like loud noises, and they get annoyed and say, "Get off my darn lawn, you kids." No, kidding. How could you see using this monster? I mean, would this be like one of those things just randomly throw at players?
Yeah, I mean, they're
trouncing around the forest and just, here's some blue Smurfs.
Well, no, they're trouncing around the forest, and all of a sudden they come upon these tigers that are just not letting them go to a certain area, at which point the players are going to be like, I want to go to that area because I'm being told not to by these tigers.
Yep, that's how players are.
Exactly. So then at that point, they start coming in and they're like trouncing all over these bamboo buildings of the Shanshu, and then they start finding their rope being tied around their ankles, and they're being tipped over like Gulliver's Travels.
Sadly, you won't be able to communicate with them because they only know their own language, Smurfy language.
Right.
And the trade language.
Right.
They're almost like Germalane.
Yeah.
But they're like a forest version of the Germalane, really.
Yeah.
And that right there makes a great adventure hook on where you're hired by some type of local government to try and make contact with this race of 1-foot humanoids to see if you can attempt some type of, you know, some dialogue.
Unfortunately, unless you know trade language, you are SOL.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's true. Yeah. But of course, you know, the DM says, hey, maybe one of these guys could speak common.
You have a tongue spell.
Yeah. That would help.
That's true.
This is the first one that actually admits that they don't speak the alignment language either.
Yeah.
Who uses that anyway?
You could always have the druid. If you have a druid-like character class, they could always, you know, turn themselves into a tiger.
Right. They speak the language of the animal court, so if you can...
There you go.
If you can communicate with animals.
Roar, roar, roar.
Send in the gnome.
Yes.
Yeah,
they speak with small, furry, woodland animals, burrowing ones.
You have a mole be the conduit between the Sanshu and the gnome.
But the that weapon that you had a hard time pronouncing, the Uchine, it's a short, heavy javelin that looks like a miniature arrow. It looks like they use it. It's got a string attached to it, so I don't know if they thrust it or they hurl it at enemies.
They hurl, maybe it gets embedded and they pull. It has like a barb to it.
Ooh.
It almost looks like a dagger of some type. It has one blade. It's kind of both sides. It's got a string at the end of it, maybe to keep it, as it's flying through the air, it stays level, maintained.
Yeah.
It's a small little tiny thing, though. It only does like 1 to 4 points of damage, I suspect. Yeah.
Check it out. If they're really threatened, they can cause disease. They don't even have to touch you for it.
Wow. All
they can do is point at you, and you're 10 feet away. Yeah.
But even then, disease won't stop
you.
You
have herpes.
Right. But then that doesn't cripple you right then in the moment. You could still kill some of them, so they still need... The disease is more down the road. You're going to be suffering a lot, but when you're first inflicted, it won't necessarily cripple you.
Wow. Ah, that's another adventure hook. To go find a cure for the diseases that these things cause people, intruders. There it goes.
Yes.
Yeah. And they kill the source.
The Sancho gave me crabs. Ah!
Never mind.
Wow. Interesting, though.
Yeah.
I like them.
Yeah,
I think they're cool.
Too.
Like I said, they're like a woodland version of the Germalite with kitty pets.
Yeah.
Surprised that a lot of these monsters in Oriental Adventures, they're really amazing, especially the undead ones.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely makes a twist in the game when they think you're fighting an undead vampire from this setting. You have to kill them a certain way. It's amazing. Good monsters here.
Yeah, a lot of them come from, I remember when we did another monster from here long time ago.
Yeah, the Kappa.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Kappa.
Jason was saying how his fiance said that a lot of these were based on Japanese legends and lore. So
yeah,
so they have some interesting legends and lore for monsters, which is really cool. So anyway, tell us what you think, and we'll head into Dragon's Horde.
As the secret portal yields to your efforts, you stand amazed at a vision from the most fevered dreams of avarice. Before you lies the Dragon's Horde.
And now, in the Dragon's Horde, well, we're going for something rather large. This isn't just your magic sword or other equipment. No, this is something that requires at least 20 men to move, as we discuss Minyan.
It's not the Ark of the Covenant?
No, the Ark of the Covenant would only require like 5 men. And if you're German, please don't look at it.
Okay. Thank God I'm not German.
Yes.
Just hold my computer. Oh, sorry. I'm dead.
But the Minyan is a large, they say, portable shrine, if you think 20 men required to carry it as portable, devoted to a particular deity. It's carried like a Panaquin, basically, when you have the pole supported by bearers.
Mm-hmm.
And monasteries and temples have this, and they're also carried into battle. And then it has a giant list of powers. It can cause fear. It can remove curses on the battlefield. The sight of it improves morale of the friendlies by 10%. And then once per month, it can be used to cast an ancient curse.
Nice.
Yeah, once per week it can heal. It's just not a standard heal.
I think it's like, I think they mean like a full heal.
Right. It's actually like a full heal. And yeah,
you're going to get all your hit points back and any diseases. And
right. It's like the magic poof. You are better.
Guys.
Yeah.
Before.
Yeah. So it's like they're most commonly held at monasteries and temples. And they are in charge of, and then they have like an abbot or a person designated to tend to them because they require a lot of maintenance. The offerings must be placed daily before it. And if they're not, it ceases to work. And then those charged with the care and those who seek aid must also be of the proper ethos or alignment. So you just can't go to the nearest monastery and have it help you. You have to be devoted to it.
Hmm.
Yeah, so it's not as easy. Just, I'm going to wander to this here village and the local monks will cure me. No, you better be the same, have the same belief system as them. Otherwise, it won't do you any good. And then on holy days, it must be paraded through the streets and shown to the population so they can see and respect it. If any of these duties are neglected, it permanently loses all of its power. So it's a very high maintenance, but powerful, somewhat portable magic item. So
Somewhat portable,
as you requires your 20 men to carry.
This isn't something you're just going to pull out of your bag of holding, folks.
No. You're not going to be going through a dungeon and happen to stumble across one of these. Well, you may.
It's almost like an artifact or a relic.
Right.
Really.
Right. Because if you find one in the wild, it won't work.
Right.
Because it's been abandoned. So, I mean, I can see using this as like a plot device. Perhaps a rival clan is coming to destroy or kidnap, so to speak, the shrine. But, mm-hmm. Or you have to defend it. Because all it takes is one day of not getting its sacrifice. And it doesn't work.
Wow. Or you can, on the opposite way, maybe you have one of these minions and it's actually for an evil deity,
right,
and you're sent out to destroy it.
Right. At which point, that would be a brutal battle because they then have all the healing and then the causing fear, where if you were a Kensai, then all of a sudden you can actually get close to it as opposed to cowering in terror. So that's where that the immunity to fear is rather important.
And it's protected by a clan of Shan Sao.
Yes.
There, we just wrote the adventure, guys. What do you think?
Right. Yeah. But I, other than using it as like a plot device, how do you guys see possibly using it?
Oh, God. I don't, beyond a plot device, I think it's pretty, that's pretty much it. I mean, it's not, I mean, yes, you can move it, but you need like 10 to 20 guys to move it. But it's not like something that, you know, you're in the heat of battle and yeah, I'm going to pull out my minion. Right. It doesn't work that way. No, it's a bigger item, and what it does, yeah, definitely a plot device thing. It's an artifact slash relic. That's where in the realms of, at least in my opinion.
Well, the kingdoms can be fighting inside of Japan, and one country or shogun wants it from the other shogun, maybe one of those type things.
I could see you even maybe doing where the it has been actually stolen by another group. And your party has to find it within the time, the one day. Otherwise, the proper sacrifice can't be made. So you actually have a really heavy time element involved in the recovery of this. So now,
and would that be, that would be a good tournament adventure then?
Yeah,
because there's a time constraint.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Yeah, because it's not as simple as just finding it. Then you have to get it back.
Yeah. There you go. Wow, that's actually pretty good. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just do it like a Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom kind of scenario.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, they stole those sacred stones from the villages that kept the village alive while the villagers died. Oh, yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, I couldn't remember what it was. But, you know, you see what I'm saying. So, yeah, great, great adventure plot there.
You ring back, see my Inga.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, you call him Dr. Jones, doll.
Dr. Jones. No time for loving, Dr. Jones.
Love that movie.
Oh, Short Round.
Oh, I couldn't stand that screaming girl. I wish they pulled her heart out and pushed her in the lava.
Wow. It's pretty.
Anyway, on topic. Tell us what you think. Write us, read us, whatever. I don't know. Talk to Will personally in Washington. I don't know.
Okay.
Let's head on to our final segment of the night.
Time is short now. They are coming swiftly, and we have but a moment. You must make your voice heard now. Cast your ballot against the 10-foot pole.
The 10-foot pole.
Oh, before you start.
What? Oh, we're not starting, okay.
Before you start the 10-foot pole, I got something to talk about on that. Just remember this. My friend Jeff was in Afghanistan.
Okay, is this
his favorite?
Off the record? Okay.
No. We could talk about it right here. This is good because it has to do with a 10-foot pole.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
This is actually very useful.
Okay.
Why this has never been thought of before in the annals of adventure gaming, or at least I'm ignorant of it until like many years ago when he brought it up to me, was his favorite class to play is a thief. He loves playing thieves. And his favorite, and he has this one character, Mornak Nighteye, and he made not just a 10-foot pole, an 11-foot pole.
An 11-foot pole.
Think about it. Most spells that are traps or trap devices work in a 10-foot radius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give you that one extra foot so you won't be caught in a radius of whatever goes off. So why have a 10-foot one when you can make an 11-foot pole? So, there you are, folks. An 11-foot pole.
That extra inch matters.
That's the extra foot. You just don't know.
Hey, it's not how you use the pole. It's, never mind.
It actually is. But anyway.
The 10-foot pole this week, the official one, is in a fight to the death, or worse, to suffer the fate of the Drider, which Dark Elf would win? The Greyhawk Drow or the Forgotten Realms Drow? What do you say, Nick?
Greyhawk Drow.
Greyhawk, okay.
Because I said so.
All right. And Will?
I have to go with the Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, brother.
Yeah.
Forgotten Realms, woo!
Yeah, I'm going Forgotten Realms too. They just enjoy the bloodshed a little too much.
Go to the site, vote often, vote as much as you want, vote three times if you want. I don't know, whatever. Just vote. Go to the site, read the reviews, comment on Will's reviews. There's a couple up right now. There'll be more to come. More articles coming. If you want to write for the site, just contact us because we are looking for writers again. So hopefully our +2 to save was Todd, right?
Yes.
Hopefully he'll come back and start writing again. You haven't seen
some good stuff.
+2 to save. Yeah, I haven't seen him in a while, so he ran out of ideas. So anyway, that's going to end the show for this week, guys.
Oh. Yes, we got a nice extended issue for those that have wanted a little bit more of us in their lives.
Yeah, so now the people who do those long drives have something special to.
And now we have actually something to look forward to in the next few months with the reprints. I think that's going to generate a lot of stuff, a lot of good things. I think so.
Hopefully. We'll see what happens. Keep it original, keep it old school, and good night, everybody.
Good night.
Night, everyone.
Have a nice week.
Roll for initiative.